Well, good morning, everyone. I want to say hi to Jackson. They're online with us, it looks like, at first. A little behind, but it seems like they're good now. Also say hi to Dan Quimby, if you've not met him. He's not too bad a guy, but you can meet him. Welcome to him today. I almost gave something very similar to what you did, so I'm glad. Last second, I thought, no, let's not do this. So the one that I have today, it dovetails really well with what Mr. Kemp gave today. There was a movie that came out when I was younger called Saving Private Ryan. I'm sure most of you have probably seen the movie, but most veterans say that it was the most realistic depiction of what World War II was like. In the beginning, the first 15, 20 minutes show the landing at Normandy, and very, very sobering to realize what those men went through. But the movie consists of, as it says, Saving Private Ryan. Private Ryan was not the main character in the movie. Private Ryan is someone that a company of men led by Tom Hanks as the actor, I'm not sure what his name was in the movie, he was to go get this guy from on the battle lines because his brothers were killed in the war, in World War II, and Congress had passed a law saying that no mother should ever have to get all of her sons be killed in a battle or in the war. So he's the last of his family, so they are sent from Normandy to go find him somewhere in Germany. That's all they knew. The communications were very rough. It was hard to figure out where people were, so they were sent to go find this Private Ryan. And it shows their trek through Germany, and of course, as you go along the way, they build the characters. Characters end up dying as they go, and they finally find Private Ryan. And they say, okay, let's get him. Let's get out of here. They weren't real happy because they had lost men with this. And as they're heading out, of course, Germans attack, and they end up in a city, and they're barricaded. They're trying to defend themselves. And as you see, more and more of the men die. And it ends up with the character that Tom Hanks plays and Private Ryan. And tanks, German men, German infantry, the tanks, they're all coming in, and they're about to be killed. Well, right at the last second, U.S. planes come over, start bombing the German tanks and infantry, and Private Ryan is saved. However, Tom Hanks, he dies from wounds there. But he tells Private Ryan something, because he had lost all these men. He had given his life as well. And he reaches to him and he says, earn this. Earn this. This is the last thing he said before he died. And the end of the movie shows the character of Private Ryan at Normandy Cemetery. And he's standing in front of Tom Hanks' character's gravesite. And his family's with him. And he asks his family, or he asks his wife, was I a good man? So it's obvious from that through his whole life, he had kept this in his heart, he had remembered it, and he had tried to be a good person. He had kept these last words as an honor to the men that died. Now, it's a fictional story, but it tells us something about the character of man. I'd like to look at something that we have been given today. We were given something with Christ's last words on earth. Let's turn to Mark 16. We all know this. I'm going to go to both versions of this. Mark 16 and verse 15. And I think any of the Sabbath-keeping and Holy Day-keeping churches do kind of take this as a mantle that we're all running with. And in verse 15 says, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. So This was given by Christ, somewhat like the Tom Hanks character, saying that this is our job. Go out, preach the gospel, and get it out to everyone. So we all have this. Does this just apply to the church organization, if you will? Or does it apply to every single one of us here? Does it apply to all of us? I'd like to tell a quick story here. Ann Sullivan, some of you know who she is. I think I gave this 5 or 6 years ago, this story. She was born in April 1866. She's born right after the Civil War. She's born in a small little village in Massachusetts. She was the oldest child of Irish immigrants who, like thousands of their fellow countrymen, they'd all left during the Great Famine from Ireland. And if you know anything about the Irish, early Irish history in the United States, it was pretty rough. Many of them were actually slaves when they got here. But as they immigrated, they were really mistreated. They weren't given jobs. It was very rough for them. Well, when Ann Sullivan put this, hard enough already, but when she's 5 years old, she gets a disease called trachoma. And it's a disease caused by bacteria in her eyes, and she has very, very serious vision problems for the rest of her life. She could see, but she has very serious problems with it. She dealt with this through her whole life, so her whole life she could relate to some of the people that she would end up working with later. But on top of this, her mother dies when she's 8 years old. So, yeah, it's a pretty rough life. Her father was, as many of the earliest Irish immigrants that we find, very serious alcoholic, and he couldn't take care of her or her little brother, and he gave them up to an orphanage. And they were sent to what's called a poorhouse at the time, and it was in Tewksbury, Massachusetts. You know where that is, Kathy? Okay. But this place was terrible, terrible place. Should have been about 100 people living in the house. It's more of an apartment type complex, but they averaged 940 people living there. So you are packed in like rats. The conditions, the mortality rate was, I saw up to 45% if you coming in there, no matter what age you were. You had a very good chance of dying because of diseases, because of the unsanitary conditions. And her little brother, Jimmy, died within 3 months of the time she lived there. Now, she was very close to him, and it affected her for the rest of her life at that time. But she found out while she was there that there was a school for blind children. And she kind of fit the bill because she occasionally would go completely blind, then her vision would come back. But she realized that maybe I can get an education through that, because she wasn't going to school living in this house like this. And she decided that was going to be her focus in life. She had no chance for any kind of life unless she did get some kind of education. Well, in 1880, a congressional group came to look at this Tewksbury almshouse to study how bad it was, because they were hearing this is very serious conditions. She followed them around. Remember, she's 14 years old at the time. She follows this group around. As they're getting ready to leave, she walks up and says, "I really would like to go to school." Well, somehow that moment changed her life. I don't know who she spoke to, but she spoke to the right person, because they sent her to something called the Perkins Institute at that time. And Perkins Institute was a pretty nice facility, and she started receiving an education there. Her experiences in life were totally different than the people that were there. Most of them came from wealthy families, and they really made fun of her, looked down on her. But at the age of 14, she couldn't even write her name. She couldn't read, and she couldn't write her name. Very fortunate that she got the shot that she did. She'd never owned a nightgown. She never had a hairbrush. She had never had anything that the other kids had. But she was very wise in the way of people because of the way she had grown up. She knew how to adapt. She knew how to read people and things like that. Now, the other little girls were, I guess you'd say, sheltered. And they ridiculed her. They made fun of her because she's different. But all it did was make her more determined. She was determined to come out of this. Now, remember, at 14 years old, she couldn't read. She couldn't write her name. By the time she was 18, she was the valedictorian of her school. This fueled her to become very ambitious. She charged her classmates, and she gave the address, the valedictorian speech. She said, "Fellow graduates, duty bids us go forth into active life. Let us go cheerfully, hopefully, and earnestly, and set ourselves to find our special part. When we have found it, willingly and faithfully perform it." She didn't even know what her, quote, special part was. But in March of 1887, she left for Tuscumbia, Alabama, to begin a new chapter in her life. And this is where we know her from. She becomes the lady that teaches Helen Keller, someone who has every disability you could think of. She's deaf, she's blind, she's mute. So how in the world do you teach someone like that? Well, she had gone to this school. Just like education classes today, you go through, and then as soon as you get into the real world, you realize you throw all that out and you teach what actually works. But she tried all of the things that they taught her at school, and Helen Keller had already received all of this, and she didn't learn anything. So Ann Sullivan had to teach her totally different methods. And that's what I want to look at today, because there's not just one way to get our message across. And today I want to look at, how did Christ teach? Because Christ didn't just, hey, real easy, get up here, give a sermon, you did your job, you're done. Christ had many, many different ways of reaching people. And when he gave us that commission, hey, we have that job to do today also. Some of these things we can all do. Some of these things, maybe it's someone else's skill set. But we can learn from the many ways that Christ taught. Let's go to Matthew 28, verse 19. Again, this is the second verse that Christ gave, the Great Commission. Matthew 28, verse 19. "Go ye therefore, teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost." Now, I think anyone that has been in the church for, if you want to say forever, but since worldwide days and all of that, it's kind of obvious that the methods from the 1960s, 1970s, they don't work today. They don't work today. But yet, Christ had many different ways. I mean, the idea of renting space on TV anymore, well, it worked when there were five channels. It doesn't work when we have 150 stations at home. Click, 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 turn off of that and go somewhere else. So the ideas that worked then, you need to tweak those some. And that's more of an organizational skill. And yet there are other ways that we can do it, because it's obvious it's not where we were when we had, 40 different feast sites, and some of them up to 12,000 people. That's not working anymore. But let's look at how Christ taught. And there are going to be five different ways. I think there are many, many other aspects of the way Christ taught. But the first one is, Christ used parables. Christ used parables. Now, if you know what a parable is simply a story. But he used stories that people could relate to. And I always learn better that way. If I could relate to something, if I could hear a story like this Ann Sullivan, if you could relate to something, it's easier to learn from that. But in the four Gospels, there are 46 different parables that Christ used. Each of these, if you look at them, related to everyday life for the people he's talking to. I don't know that you could get up here and start talking about what you're going to do in Manhattan and relate that to everyone that lives here, because we don't live there. So it's very hard to tie in, okay, what do you do in a very large urban city compared to the way most of us live, either suburban or rural areas. But Christ used livestock in some cases. He used family issues, manual labor in many of his stories. And he talked about servants, things that the people back then could relate to. What can we use today? Any of the stories that we can relate to. But he used stuff that connected you to what he's talking about. But there's something else about a parable that makes it unique, the way Christ did this. And when you really think about it, it's very, very deep the way he did. Let's look at Matthew 13. Because it would be so nice to just be able to get up, speak about something, and everyone that hears it, oh yeah, that I agree, I'm 100%. It's not the way it works. Matthew 13, verses 10 through 11. So they're a little lost about the stories that he's telling, his disciples. And verse 10, it says, "And the disciples came and said to him, 'Why do you speak to them in parables? Why are you making this difficult?' And he answered and said to them, 'Because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given.'" So this kind of tells us that no matter whether we are doing our job, it doesn't mean we're going to reach everybody. We have that job to do, but it doesn't mean that everyone is going to be reached. And when you think about a parable, you don't really understand something, you spend time dwelling on it, don't you? You think about that story. If you just heard something and oh, well, I get it, I don't need to think about that anymore. But when you don't really understand something, your mind starts working where you're trying to connect the dots. So I think telling stories the way he did was a way to get people engaged in that. But we still, again, how nice would it be to just say, okay, this is the way you should live, and everyone lived that way. But there's another verse, John 6:44. You don't need to go there because you all know it. And it says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him at the last days." Would be real nice, again, all of our families, whoever, our friends, understood all of this. But it takes the Father. He has to draw you first. Again, we have that job to do, but it takes the Father saying, hey, let's take this person and use them. Another way that Christ used, and this is something that every single one of us can do, and we have really truly a daily opportunity to do this, is Christ used small gatherings at the spur of a moment. Small gatherings, it's a spur of the moment. Any little thing that pops up, there's your teaching opportunity. And an example of this is John 8. John 8, several verses here. John 8, verses 2 through 12. And it gives this story where he does has had this opportunity at the time. We know this story well, but let's go through it. John 8, verse 2 says, "Now early in the morning he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them." So here he's doing the whole teaching in an atmosphere like this. And then an opportunity arises. "Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. What do you say?' So they're testing him. They want to get him in trouble and take him before the courts. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger as though he did not hear them. Verse 7, they're continuing to bother. Hey, we want an answer from you. So they continued asking him. He raised himself up and he said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest even to the last. When Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst, when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Then Jesus spoke to them, verse 12, again, saying, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." How many times have we had this moment happen in our lives? Whether it's something to do with, let's say, our beliefs on holidays, Christmas, the Sabbath. How many times have we kind of maybe skirted this issue rather than, hey, this is my moment to explain where we are? I've done it because it's easier, isn't it? It's easier just to let's avoid this than to actually stand up because, hey, Christ told us, preach this gospel. Well, here's one of those opportunities to do it. I don't know how many of you see, I'm going to throw him under the bus because he told me he was going to make me his autobiography writer, Mr. Leon Daniels over there. But if you've ever seen some of his Facebook posts, there's no hem-hawing about that. It's your belief and that's it. And Leon's standing for that. Leon also has a radio program. And he's reaching people. Again, probably these people aren't listening, just like every time we talk. But he's reaching people that no one else is going to. So there's these opportunities to teach. And when we have that, do we take it or do we not? We can't let these opportunities slip by. It's time to say, this is my belief. You're not going to change me on it. But when he has these spur of the moment, when we have them, Christ used them, when we have them, we need to take those. The third way that Christ spoke is in large groups. Large groups. And let's look at Matthew 5. So we look at the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, verses 1 and 2. And it says, "Seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and he taught them." And now we go through the entire Sermon on the Mount, perhaps the greatest sermon ever given. I'd say it'd have to be. It's Christ's words directly. The Sermon on the Mount, but he speaks to a huge audience. He speaks to all the people that are gathered there. Matthew 7, verse 28 and 29, at the end of the sermon, it says, "And so it was when Jesus had ended these sayings that the people were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." So this is where we are here within a church organization. This type of large service, yeah, that's something that for most of us, that's not going to happen very often. But Christ had this as well. But in just this group, I don't know, 50, 60 people here, just to make this work, if you're part of that group and whatever organization, if you're part of that group, just putting the chairs out, just coffee, everything. Because you see the disciples, what were they doing at one point? They're feeding the people that are there. So it takes a group effort even in that. Yeah, someone can step up, give the sermon message or whatever, and oh, they did a good job. But it takes everything. It takes every single person to make something work, especially in a larger organization. I'm not going to mention this church because I don't want to get in trouble if it ever goes out there. But there's a church in Lakewood, Texas. Seats 16,800 people. 16,000. It was a former NBA arena. And they have four English language and two Spanish language services each weekend. More than 43,000 people attend there every single weekend. And that's not including the media. I'm sure they probably have well over a million people at least on their media. That's more than all of the Sabbath-keeping groups probably in the whole world right now. 43,000 people go to one area and one church. If you've watched it, this is professionally done. I mean, it looks like something that was created by Hollywood, the way they do this. This is very good. But if you listen to the messages, there's not much there. And many times, I think they've changed a little bit because they start getting heat, there would be a 30-minute message and not a single scripture. We live in a feel-good world right now. So a message like ours is going to be very difficult. It's going to be very hard to, we're never going to draw 43,000 people in one area of the world, let's face it, because it says we're small flocks. But we still have that job, and that's where we have the organizations that try to reach in large ways, whether it's through internet, whether it's through websites, whatever you put out, even YouTube videos, things like that. I don't know. Does anyone use Twitter and stuff? I think some people use Twitter. I don't know that the churches actually use that. But all of these ways, this is big organization stuff, but we're all a part of it. We're all a part. You pick up a chair. You bring in food. You open the hall. All of this is part of doing our jobs. The fourth way that Christ used was, remember, he only had 3.5 years on earth, or ministry, sorry, but he used urgency and conviction. He used urgency and conviction. And we'll find this in Matthew 23. Matthew 23. Matthew 23 and verse 33. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? This is when you have that teaching opportunity, you hit it head on with this. You're telling people in control, you're calling them probably some of the worst names you could actually call them at the time. This is urgency. And again, he knew he only had this short time. But this is with conviction. This isn't, well, I think you guys are wrong. No, this is hitting it head on with this. Every single word that Christ spoke, because it did seem kind of strange sometimes when you read, Christ would just sit there for a moment, and they're probably looking, is he going to answer us? But every single word he spoke had that conviction behind it. He didn't waste time with a lot of foolish talk. Everything had conviction behind it. Let's look at Matthew, just jump over Matthew 24. It's Matthew 24, the disciples ask Christ about the end time. They're thinking, hey, it's their time. I think every generation has thought that. Paul certainly thought it at his time as well. But they ask Christ about the signs at the end of the time. Matthew 24 and verse 4. It says, and Jesus answered and said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled at all. These things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilence, earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginning of sorrows. I think we could look at this now. We see all of this occurring around the world right now. Don't know that this is the end time, because I was told when I was 10 years old, don't worry, you're not going to have kids. And now we're going to have a boatload of grandchildren, it looks like. So we don't know when the time of the end. We can watch these things, but then you see people that, it's going to happen here, it's going to happen here. And what happens when it doesn't? Well, you have just, I won't say completely went against God, but you certainly took something for granted that you shouldn't have, because no one knows the end time, but you can watch all of these things and see. Should we have that same urgency that Christ did? I think we probably should, because, yeah, it does look like it's lining up. Throughout Paul's life, look at the urgency he had. Everything that he did, it was all or nothing most of the time. Peter, certainly, you could say that about. But they had this urgency. They had this conviction. Now, go down to Matthew 24, verse 14. And it tells you, yes, everything's lining up. Like Mr. Kemp said, it's looking bleak, but it has to for Christ to come back. Verse 14, it said, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. Then the end will come. It's very hard to reach people when it's all shut off, right? But I think the ability, the internet, everything, it's there. Even in countries, in communist areas and stuff, there are ways to find it. And no matter what's our job? Our job is to preach the gospel. You and I, we might do it at a very small local level. We do it with tithes and offerings and things like that at a larger area. But we each have our own job to do. Whether we reach people, hey, it says we're not going to reach everybody. Father has to call them, but we still have our job to do. We need that urgency that Christ showed. We need to have it in our life. The last one is probably personally for each of us the most important one of these, because it's something that every single one of us can do every day of our life. And it was, how did he teach? His example. The fifth way is his example. Let's look at this example in Mark 2, verses 15 through 17. It says, now it happened as he was dining in Levi's house that many tax collectors and sinners also sat together with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many and they followed him. So he's sitting with the people that aren't well thought of. They're thought of as cheats, liars, and thieves. Verse 16, and when the scribes and Pharisees saw him eating with the tax collectors and sinners, they said to his disciples, how is it that he eats and drinks with tax collectors and sinners? Verse 17, here he shows his personal example here. Jesus heard it. He said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Christ never sinned in his entire life, only human being to ever have that, as he came from spirit being to a human. Unfortunately, we cannot say that. If you can, I think you might have some more problems if you think you could say that. But we could do the best that we can. Every part of our life should, if we have the fruits of God's Spirit. Last week in Pentecost when we were given this ability, most of our life should show this. There was a man years ago in the church that was a deacon, very well thought of in church. spoke, did it, all of the things that you think of as someone, pillar. And he died a few years ago, and when I went to his funeral, come find out the local people in his town knew him as the guy that shut down the bars every night. Because at home, he lived a different life. We can't live one life here and then one life out there. That's not the example. Who's going to see that example and say, boy, I want what they have? That's not the example that we personally should be setting. We need to, you think about the light on the hill. They talk about that in the Bible. But I think of a runway of an airport. And if you're coming in, you see those runway lights. But the one thing that really sticks out is when there's a light out right there. That one light that's not lighting the runway up, that's the one you see. So if we have all of these people, there's lights on the hill, and then there's that one that's not lit, that's the one that stands out at that point. And that's why we have to choose who we're going to be with. Are we going to be with those lights, or do we want to be with a whole bunch of people that are all dark and never showing their light? So with our own example, we could choose who we want to be with and how we're going to be out there, not in here, because everyone can fake it for 2 hours, but how we are out there. With those small opportunities that we have every day, do we show that example that's right? Let's turn to one more passage, Galatians 5. These scriptures used to be just something you memorize and be done with, but as you look into it, every one of these are so deep that our whole lives, if we have these, it will be our light. It will be our way to show other people how you should live, or have someone say, this is what we want. Galatians 5, verses 22 and 23, very simple. This fruits of the Spirit. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. We want to show these examples. We want to teach the way Christ did. This is it. These. And they're so intertwined. Long-suffering, patience. That doesn't run in my family. It never has. I remember working with my dad. He'd throw tools across the yard, working on tractor, whatever. And even back when I'm dating my wife, I remember she'd come out to where I was working, and I'd sling something all the way across the yard. And I'm sure my kids, I'm sure Dalton's much better than that, but whatever. But all of these are things, pick one of these that you need to work on. You may have very strong gifts in some of these, and others you don't. But all of these are so intertwined from love to joy. All of these show that way that Christ lived. No doubt Christ was the perfect example of all of these fruits of the Spirit. But as we continue, and like Mr. Kemp said, are we at the end time? I don't know. You don't know. We could speculate. But as we do this, we really do need to realize everyone's not going to be called. But again, Christ gave us one thing to do at the end. He gave us all of this content before. But at the end, he said, go into the world and preach the gospel. So, brethren, you may not be up here. We may not be on TV, but each and every one of us do have a job to do.